You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today, sitting in for my lovely mother, is my lovely friend, Paul Gandy.
Okay, that's all right. It's kind of a compliment. Thank you.
It's very much a compliment. And of course, people in Fairfield know Mr. Gandy as a local attorney specializing in the area of
fresh starts,
also known as
some bankruptcy.
And he's back with us today to help me interview this a very prestigious guest that we have with us today.
That's true, Dr. Ravi Batra. Dr. Batra is a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, SMU, and he's written a number of books. In our last interview with him, which was on November 14th, we spoke in some detail about his most recent book,
titled
The New Golden Age,
The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. Very interesting book. So interesting, in fact, that we wanted to have a second interview to talk about a less recent book, but no less interesting.
And no less topical at
indeed,
the moment.
Indeed. Titled, well, it's a very provocative title, you tell me, Greenspan's Fraud. How two decades of his policies have undermined the global economy. I believe, Dr. Batra, that book was written, if I'm reading the preface correctly, you were writing that book around the early part of 2005?
Dr. Batra, can you hear us?
Barely.
Oh, okay. Barely, okay. Well, welcome to Writers' Voices.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Yes, and we were just talking about your book, the Golden Age, of course, we spoke about and interviewed at some length last month. But today we want to talk about that book, your current predictions, your comments, your observations of what's been happening now in the world economy and the U.S. economy, and also about a book of yours, I believe published in 2005, titled Greenspan's Fraud. Now, as I understand it, that book was published in 2005 and you are 2006, I believe, and you wrote it primarily in the late 2004 and early 2005. Is that correct?
Actually, it was published in 2005, and at that time, Greenspan was still the chairman of the Federal Reserve. So people just said that you got incredible amount of guts to go against and man of such stature, and you're an economist. Nobody's going to believe you, and people are going to laugh at you. And I said, well, you know, I just look for the truth, and wherever it takes me, that's what I report. It doesn't matter what happens to my career. I need to straighten out some things that he's doing. He's not doing things which are right, and pretty soon we'll realize that he has wrecked the entire world economy, and that's why I just went ahead and wrote the book Greenspan's Fraud, and that's essentially why I chose this title, also the strongest possible title.
Very provocative.
There's no question about your position, I think. It's clear for you to say.
Well, exactly. I wanted to make sure that people know where I stand. It is not wishy-washy that he has done a few things wrong. No, he has done a whole spectrum of bad things in the economy, and they are so bad that in just a few years, the whole world will be in trouble, and that's what we find right now. We are in an awful lot of trouble right now.
Now, I'm assuming that when this book was published, you probably did get some backlash from it.
There were a lot of backlash.
That was one of the questions we had in our minds based on from our last conversation. We're thinking, well, you make rather strong statements, and this book is no less so, and maybe even more so because of the title. What has been the effect on your, you mentioned your career, what has been the effect on your career and your position in the world
economists? You know, people don't invite you for lectures, no more seminars, no more promotions, no more raises. You know, I mean, all sorts of bad things happen when they don't like your views.
Do you have tenure?
Yeah, I had tenure 30 years ago. That has not been a problem. In fact, that's one reason why I've been so bold, that I have tenure. And this is what people should realize, how important tenure is for the speaker of the truth. Those who want to speak out the truth, for them, job security is very important. All right, suppose you can do away with raises and promotions, but at least your livelihood is secured, and then you can go ahead and talk about the truth in the economy.
Now, Dallas is a fairly conservative town. My daughter moved there from Austin a few years ago, and she has certainly found that to be true. And I'm guessing that Southern Methodist University is a fairly conservative university. So do you...
Sounds like it.
Do you get some flack from the university?
Yeah, I get a lot of flack from colleagues, from all sorts of sources. So there's but now...
But now.
Yeah, now they're giving me a hearing. They invited me to a seminar a week ago and asked me to explain what's going on. And then when I talked about how productivity is rising so fast and wages are not, and that's the main cause of the entire situation, entire trouble, they didn't believe me there because that's a theory which is totally new to them. They would even question that wages are not rising. And I said, my God, where do these guys live? So then I had to show them some books in which it's very clearly mentioned that the real wages are falling for the entire nation while productivity is going up. And this was news to them. That was amazing.
Wow.
To
your fellow economists.
Yeah, to my fellow economists, it was news that the real wages are actually falling in the United States.
When was this? Was even though you had written the book, and of course you in this book, your most recent book,
Anna Greenspan's Clock, people have been talking about. So that's the way the economics profession is.
Now, what do you think it is, Dr. Batra, in your background that caused you to be able to depart so
radically
from the standard wisdom in economics?
Well, a long time ago, I met a spiritual teacher in India, and by the way, P.R. Sarkar, and the theories that I've expounded in that book, The New Golden Age, are Sarkar's theories. And he told me at that time, he said that if you want to get ahead in spirituality, if you want to really see your maker face to face, then you have to give up everything for the sake of the truth. And then you have to sacrifice everything for the sake of the truth, and then the world will be unhappy, but the supreme entity will be very happy with you. So I said, well, I'll choose that path, and that's exactly why that's what is in my background, which simply will not let me compromise with lies and misleading statements.
But even so many people really believe the, you know, the kind of classical economic theories, the Milton Friedman.
Actually,
and so forth.
Some people believe, those people who are just in the academia, just teaching their classes, using their textbooks, they certainly believe that. But those who are making policies, economic policies, they don't believe what they say. They just lie.
Mm.
And in fact, they lie to such an extent that they even won't give you the right information. They will withhold some information. And I have a chapter, if you recall, in that other book. What was the name of the chapter? Lies, Damned Lies, and Economists.
Now, I'm very interested in asking about or getting your comments or observations of the situation we find ourselves currently in the world economy and the U.S. economy. But if we could have a little background. Now, in your book, Greenspan's Fraud, you state that he's a fraud on two fronts, intellectually, I believe you state, and politically. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you mean?
That's right. He has committed an intellectual fraud as well as... I would say is a tax fraud. In the early 1980s, the Social Security Fund had a little shortfall. They were short of about $20 billion. But the U.S. government had a huge budget deficit of about $200 billion, and the budget deficit had resulted from huge income tax cut, which is what Reagan had wanted, and which is what the supply-side economists wanted.
The huge cut, was it 1981, was it?
That their tax cuts would create so much growth, and there will be so much extra revenue from that growth, that in the end we will have a budget surplus certainly not a budget deficit. But then, in the early 80s, the algebra just did not cooperate with their theory. When you cut the income tax sharply and say that you're going to balance the budget, this is nonsense.
There was something then back called the Laffer curve, is that right?
And at that time, the United States was not easily was not able to borrow money from China and Japan. They didn't have that much money to lend. So when the U.S. faced such huge budget deficits, the interest rates skyrocketed. And that killed our economy in the early 80s. We had the worst recession since the war at that time, other than the current one. In the early 80s, we had the terrible recession. So now, revenue had to be increased to balance the budget or to bring the budget deficit down. So here Greenspan comes up with a strategy. He tells the public, we will raise your Social Security tax, save that extra revenue, and use it to guarantee your benefits in the future. Social Security benefits would be guaranteed in the future. That's what he told the public. But in reality, he wanted to raise revenue so that the government's budget deficit would fall, and that was intentional. I've shown in the book that he was aware of the fact that no such thing would happen, and we know now from history that Social Security tax jumped, the self-employment tax jumped, and not a single penny of this was saved, because today the Social Security Trust Fund is empty as it was at that time. So whatever money they raise has been used up to finance the tax cuts of the wealthy, the income tax cuts for the wealthy. And that is what I call tax fraud or Social Security fraud. It's fraud that, in the sense that he knew what he was doing and still did it.
And most people today still believe that the Social Security system is in trouble, that that the benefits are still in danger because and the thing that was believable was this fact that the baby boomer group was so large, and that when they start retiring, there'll only be three workers supporting each retiree, whereas in the past it was six or eight or ten workers per retiree. And that's really become just accepted as truth and fact without anybody questioning it anymore.
That's right.
You have a different point of view.
I think
you state in your book,
we can fix everything in the economy if there is a will to do it. I mean, this is a...
You state in your book, in Greenspan's fraud, I understand it, Social Security ought to be funded pay-as-you-go. The problem with creating a surplus is that the surplus will be spent. It won't be a surplus. The government and our political will is such that it would be too tempting to spend the money. So rather than create a surplus, if we need to raise Social Security taxes because of an increase in the recipients, then you raise it at that time or as you go, or increase the wage limit for which there is a tax of Social Security.
It's also interesting that I think most people don't think about Social Security taxes when they think about tax.
This is the amazing part. This is all the propaganda machine of controlled by the wealthy.
Exactly.
You keep hearing again and again that Reagan cut taxes. Everybody, every Republican will jump up and say, oh, that's the Reagan Revolution. He cut taxes.
Right.
But that's not true. He cut taxes for about 20-30% of the public, and raise them for 100% of the public.
Through the Social Security tax.
Social Security tax, excise tax, gasoline tax, you name it. He raised all of the taxes and cut the income tax.
So the tax system become more regressive? In other words, lesser income was responsible for generating more of the tax revenue rather than the other way around, more greater income responsible for...
The system became very regressive, and... just because he cut the income tax, people say, well, he cut taxes. The thing is that he raised taxes for everybody else and raised most other taxes, I think all other tax rates, simply to make his rich friends happy. And then they claimed that this will promote growth. In fact, growth came down. And that's what I've shown in the book, why growth would fall if you have a regressive tax system. And that is, it is supported by logic. It's also supported by history.
You say growth came down and also the deficit exploded.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and guest host today, Paul Gandy. And we are interviewing Dr. Ravi Batra, author of Greenspan's Fraud, How Two Decades of His Policies Have Undermined the Global Economy. Dr. Batra, let's explore this idea more about tax, income tax cuts not resulting in growth, because I bet if you go out and ask 90% of the people you meet on the street, they still think that that's always the case. But if you look at the history, that's not true.
Oh, no. Income tax, whenever income taxes are very high in the United States, growth is the strongest. And this is the reason. For a CEO, for instance, he makes $50 million. And that money is sitting idle. It's either going into speculation or it is sitting in the bank. He just wants to lend that money to other people. He wants borrowers for his money, but mostly that money is sitting idle. It is not being invested into new factories, at least not in the United States. Suppose you were to tax a part of that income, a large part of that income, and give tax relief to the poor, then the poor will spend almost everything that they get in the form of tax relief. Demand, consumer demand will go up, and when consumer demand rises, factories will produce more. Growth will be higher. Production will be higher, growth will be higher. So we find in history that in the 1950s and the 1960s, we had the strongest growth rates in the United States at a time when the marginal, when the top bracket income tax rate was as high as 90%.
Wow.
So, and this information, those economists who make policies, they don't let this information come out. I have looked at the textbooks that these people have written, like Ben Bernanke. He has written a textbook in macroeconomics. It does not mention even once that the income tax rate in the United States in the 1950s was as high as 91%.
Why not? Why aren't your front page or mainstream economists talking about this?
Well, because these mainstream economists get their professorships, their distinguished professorships from the CEOs, from the wealthy people. Mm.
You mentioned in your previous book, or the book we spoke about last
month, Caesar Professor of Economics. Somebody's the Alexander the Great Professor of Economics. I'm just kidding, but this is what they have. They have these professorships or chairs which they obtain from the very wealthy people. So how can they possibly suggest that high income tax rates actually stimulate growth under capitalism?
Professor, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
All right. You mentioned in our previous interview, and we were talking about your most recent book, The New Golden Age, that it was this situation where your typical economist doesn't talk about these facts about tax policies, that the reason is, if I understand your book, it's the kind of age we're in or leaving where so many interests serve the wealthy. Even the intellectual interest, academia, serves the interests of the wealthy. And so it would be consistent with your analysis. Tell me if I'm wrong. I'd like your comment on this. Consistent with your analysis that a typical professor of economics is going to not talk about the effects of aggressive taxation because it doesn't please the people who rule or run society, that being the wealthy.
Exactly. They're not going to talk about a lot of things. They're not going to talk about excessive concentration of wealth. They're not going to talk about low income tax rates and high taxes on the poor and the middle class. Look at the self-employment tax. The self-employment tax went up in 1983 by 66%. The Republican government, along with the Democrats, raised this self-employment tax by 66% in 1983. And John McCain voted for this tax increase, by the way. And he claims to be a friend of the small business. The self-employed people are small business people.
Exactly.
They raise their tax 66% and they claim to be friends of the small business just because they cut the income tax rates. The small business people mostly are the most affected by this self-employment tax.
Yes, and really the very small business people, the single, you know, the sole proprietor tradesperson, your carpenter, your painter, your plumber, they're the ones that are the most affected by that, because if you get a little larger, people incorporate and they do S-corps and they can avoid much of that tax through, you know, through different strategies, which as a tax accountant I'm very familiar with, and are very abused, by the way, by not my clients, but I've seen it by other clients. And so it's really the people making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 that are hit the hardest.
And they have to pay 15%.
Right off the top.
15% right off the top. And
yep. We have a train that goes by right outside our window, so that may be what you're hearing.
Duck. Professor, in your book, I think in both your books, you stated that the trade deficit was, well, let me go back to your Greenspan's book in 2005. The trade deficit was then the biggest reason for the American economic malaise. Do you believe that now?
Yes. In fact, when people have called me, some reporters have called me, what should be done to fix our economy, that's the top on my list. Because we are now lamenting that we are losing manufacturing jobs. Well, of course we are losing manufacturing jobs. Why wouldn't we if the trade deficit is so high? Because we import manufactured goods. So anytime they try to create more stimulus, our imports will rise even further. So the stimulus effect will be very limited without controlling this trade deficit.
Now, you mentioned, I think, in both your books, you speak of an idea of something called a two-tier system of exchange rates. Your position is, I believe, that would resolve this issue, solve this problem?
That's right. If we were to have two types of exchange rates, one for the exporters, one for the foreigners who buy our goods, that is, and import our goods, or those who export our goods, and the other rate for all other transactions, and we can have a very low export exchange rate, so low that U.S. exports become very attractive to foreign countries. The prices of U.S. exports sharply go down. So as our export prices fall in foreign countries, then they will buy our goods a lot more than before. That will then tend to balance our trade, and this is a policy that China and many Asian countries have been following for the past 20 years. So we'll be kind of reciprocating what they are doing, and so obviously this is consistent with world trade system, WTO, so we can do the same thing and try to balance our trade.
Well, Dr. Batra, does the government have to make up that difference in the exchange rate to somebody? I mean, where does
Well, we'll be doing exactly what the Chinese and the Japanese do. They make up the difference by keeping their own exchange rate very low. So our Federal Reserve will also make up the difference between the official, the market-determined rate and the export exchange rate. The Federal Reserve will make a difference. So we'll be accumulating foreign currencies just as the Chinese and the Japanese are accumulating dollars. So it will be same kind of reciprocal action.
So basically the Federal Reserve would buy those foreign currencies from the exporters?
That's right. And give them the foreign
the market rate
at a low rate.
Okay.
The result is that our export prices will fall by about 20-30% to foreign countries, and when our prices go down that much, they will buy a lot more from us. So the details are there in the book. But the whole idea is that we essentially devalue our dollar the way the Chinese and the Japanese have devalued their currencies.
You're saying this is a trade surplus.
Exports.
Trade surplus countries are doing this, have been doing this already for some time.
That's what, yeah, we will do it with the trade surplus countries, yes.
Now, so this is a different strategy than applying tariffs on imports.
Right. Tariffs will cut imports. Tariffs will cut imports and raise import prices, but here the import prices will not change because we are not imposing any tariffs. All that will happen is that our exports will go up, but there will be no effect on import prices. So that's why this strategy has been designed just for today's problem.
It seems so elegant, so simple. Why aren't we doing it? It seems so elegant, Doctor. It seems so simple. Why aren't we doing it?
Well, you know, you win Nobel Prizes by not offering radically new ideas. And this is a radically radical idea,
You're stating that other countries are doing it, and I think you said that they've been doing it for 20 years, China and Japan, for example. So our country, I mean, at the levels of economic policy that view these things, understand these things, and I'm not at that level, they're aware this is happening. Is that true?
Trade deficit is killing our manufacturing base. I mean, there are so many stories we find in the newspapers, and the economists also are beginning to realize that the trade deficit is crippling our manufacturing, but they are still not willing to take radical steps. And in today's world, actually, if they took a radical step now, things will get worse for a while. And so we are in a very, very boxed in right now.
Mm. Dr. Batra, before we move completely away from the Social Security tax fraud issue that we were discussing, do you think, you know, there's various proposals for economic stimulus, getting more money in the hands of, and they all seem to be focused around income tax. Do you think that cutting the Social Security tax rate now, since it actually isn't, you know, since the Social Security is actually operating at a surplus, that cutting the Social Security tax rate would be a good way to provide an economic stimulus now?
That would be a better way than cutting the income tax.
Because it puts it in the hands of the people who will
really need
it.
That's the way to provide economic stimulus. Because, yeah. In fact, almost 40% of Americans pay no income taxes at all, whereas everybody pays the Social Security tax. I would cut the Social Security tax for everybody who earns less than $50,000 and not for anybody else.
And perhaps raise the limit over time as needed?
As a temporary stimulus measure, we can do that just until the economy recovers, and then we take long-run...
In your book, Greenspan's...
Long-run reform so that this thing does not make a comeback.
I understand. In your book, Greenspan's Fraud, you noted, I think one of your policies was to eliminate the Social Security tax for incomes of $10,000 or less. Do you still...
Yeah, right. I would still do that and raise the Social Security tax for those with higher incomes.
Now, we're setting this background, I hope, so we can ask some questions about what's going on today. That's what I'm as interested in, even more so. Since we spoke in November, mid-November, we've had another crisis, namely the crisis regarding our domestic automobile manufacturers, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. They've looked to the government for some relief, some bailout money, I guess you would call it, like the government has worked with the financial industry. What's your take, Doctor, on this domestic automotive crisis that we seem to have been in for the last, well, it's been front page news, let's just say, for the last month and a half?
Well, I have suggested that the government should buy the shares of auto industries and give those shares to the workers. And then it's up to workers to decide how they want to save their jobs. They can retain the current management or get another management. They will also have to decide which cars they want to produce. And if we give shares to the workers of these industries, they are not going to lay off anybody. What they will do is to reduce the working hours for everybody. So nobody's laid off, and there's no additional trauma to these workers. But output will fall because there is not much demand for these goods, and the government's cost will be just less than $5 billion. The government can also help in reducing the health care and pension costs of these industries. That will take another $10 billion. So with $15 billion, we can create a viable auto industry. We don't have to spend a lot more money that they're talking about.
Will people buy these cars?
Well, when the workers' jobs are on the line, first of all, they will be hard. There will be no instances of union inflexibility. Secondly, they will produce only cars which sell. They will not be producing the cars that the management prefers. The question is, what's a better alternative? Right now, the government is going to bail them out, and they're talking about $25 billion, $50 billion, who knows. And they're not sure even then if that will save the industry.
Well, Dr. Batrad, I'd like to believe that you're right and that having the workers control the companies would help, but what makes you actually believe that they'll do a better job of managing these companies than the professional managers?
They are not going to manage the company. It will still be managed by experts. The only thing is that now they will have to be very flexible in job situations. They will have to be flexible, plus nobody will be fired. Now, what they are currently talking about is bailing out the auto industry, and they tell the auto industry that by March they have to fire some 30,000-40,000 workers so that they're competitive. Now, what kind of solution is that? You're giving so much money to the auto industry anyway, and yet they are going to fire people? I mean, what's the point?
Because then you have fewer people that can afford to buy the cars, and it's just a downward spiral.
But if the working hours are reduced, everybody's wages will fall in the auto industry, but at least nobody would be fired. This way now, some thousands of people will be laid off, and then the government will have to pay them unemployment compensation. And the government doesn't have unlimited amounts of money.
This sounds like, Doctor, what you refer to in both your, I know in the Greenspan book, as mass capitalism, as opposed to, I guess, what you're observing today as monopoly capitalism.
Right. I call it mass capitalism because this is property ownership among the masses, among the thousands and thousands of employees. Plus, you know, these workers will have an incentive to make their companies profitable, because if the companies start earning profit, the value of their shares will also rise sharply. So they will have a lot of incentive, a lot of great motives to work hard and produce the best quality cars in the world. Right now, they don't have that motive. Right now, it's okay, the government is going to give us these funds, and we will just do exactly what we have been doing for some time. And
come back in the spring.
What I'm saying is there will be much bigger, greater motivation for them to be efficient if you hand the ownership of the companies to the workers. But the workers are not going to manage. They will still hire experts to manage the companies. The only thing is the experts will not be paid outlandish salaries, because since workers control the companies, they will not be paying millions of dollars in compensation to the executives. And that's the very purpose of mass capitalism, because in the end, it's extreme concentration of wealth that is responsible for today's global financial crisis.
Well, in capitalism, we have the unions, we have the shareholders, we have the managers, and it seems like the way things have developed, everyone's just trying to extract the most current value that they can get, and nobody's looking at the long-term value in these companies. So the CEOs, the managers get these huge outlandish salaries. The unions just go for higher wages, and won't ever compromise. And the shareholders, many of them are really just speculators.
Exactly. So if the workers were controlling these industries, then they will be looking at the long term because their jobs are on the line. And the executives or the managers they hire will also then be looking at the long term because they will have to please look for the interests of the workers. The interests of the manager will lie in serving the interests of their employees. This way, the manager will be rewarded if the company does well. The manager will not get the reward if the company does poorly. So the managers also will have the incentive to look for the long-term interests of the company and not go for the short-term advantages.
We wanted to interview you today, Doctor, and last month, not only because your analysis is unique, but your predictions have so far been stunningly accurate. We want to talk about what's happening now and what you see happening going forward. Now, the president-elect has chosen an economic team. I think he chose it between the time we last spoke in November. What's your observation or take on the economic team selections to date?
Well, see, president-elect has chosen people of great experience. But people of great experience tend to have old ideas. They don't have new ideas. So he also has no choice but to select people of experience because he wants to restore confidence first in himself and also among people that he knows what he's doing. So he really has no choice to try new ideas right now. And since we're not going to try new ideas, that means this will be business as usual. And so whatever they do will be a failure in the first 6 months of this year. Then they will realize that we have to try something new. So by that time, the economy will be in a terrible shape.
Well, now we're talking about, an economic plan, which is going to be on the president's desk within the first few days, apparently, when he enters office, of a spending program of anywhere from $500 billion to $1 trillion I think the idea is to repair our infrastructure, build, repair roads, highways, schools, and so forth. Are you saying that would be that's going to be a failure? It's not going to succeed?
Yes, it will not succeed because the assumption the government is making now is that we can borrow billions of dollars, and there will be no cost to this. The cost will be high interest rates. Because the world doesn't have that much money to lend to us now. The world itself has lost billions in the stock market. So they don't have that much money to lend to us. So if we want to borrow this much money from the world and from our own people, then interest rates will have to be higher. And as interest rates go up, whatever positive effect comes from the road building will be neutralized by the negative effects of these high interest rates. So I don't think this is going to really work.
So when the United States goes out into the bond market or the debt market to sell bonds to raise $500 billion plus, the rate's going to be forced up. You're saying it's going to be forced up immediately, or is there going to be some delay? I think the government, the president-elect is talking. He understands. He says the deficit we can worry about later. Right now we have to do something to get the economy moving. And, of course, it is a traditional response, I believe, to spend, the government to spend money. But you're saying, is that interest rate push going to come right away when they enter the markets apparently within the first few months of the new year or this year, or is it going to be a delayed effect?
As they start to borrow that money.
Right away.
So, Dr. Batra, what would you advise them to do instead?
I would advise them to use their spending very carefully. First of all, don't bail out Wall Street firms. Don't bail out big banks. Some of the banks don't even need the money, and they have been forcing that money on them so that they would lend more money. It is foolishness to expect the banks to increase their lending because the banks are not being paid back the previous loans. People are defaulting on those loans already. Then how do you expect the bank to increase the lending even if the government gives them the money? Because what if the money doesn't come back?
And there aren't enough credit-worthy borrowers wanting to borrow.
Exactly. But the borrowers have already used up their home equity. And even if they do have home equity, home prices are falling. So why would banks want to lend money even if the government gives them the money?
So what happened to the plan to use this bailout money to buy distressed mortgages?
Every time you can have plans on paper, but when you start implementing them, they become very complicated. There are thousands of banks involved, and the Treasury Department simply could manage it. So they abandoned the plan.
So you don't think it was an intentional thing where they said, oh, this is what we're going to use the money for because that was more amenable to the public, but really all along they were just going to give it to the banks?
No, actually, they were manipulating it was intentional. Hank Paulson wanted to bail out his Wall Street buddies, and therefore he said we need to bail out banks. But why are we bailing out Wall Street then if we want to bail out banks? That I don't understand. So in the name of bailing out banks, he bailed out Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and so on. Those are Wall Street banks. They're not lenders. They're borrowers. So why are we bailing out the borrowers if we want to increase lending in the economy?
What's going to happen this 2009? You're saying, of course, there's going to be a massive spending package. I think that's pretty much a given. It's not going to work. It's going to push interest rates up, I think you're saying, immediately and sharply. What's going to happen then as we get to the middle of the year?
Well, see, the interest rates don't have to rise sharply. They just have to rise a little because corporations that want to borrow money nowadays, they're already paying very high interest rates, higher than 2 years, what they were 2 years ago, even though the Federal Reserve has sharply cut interest rates. Most corporations are paying very high interest rates because the banks don't have the confidence in the system anymore. So if the interest rates go up even slightly, the rates facing the corporations will jump faster than that. So it will have a negative impact on hiring and on production. So that's why I think the negative impact from the higher interest rates will collide with the positive impact from extra spending by the government, and the two will neutralize themselves. And right now the people are so focused on Obama, and when they found that there is not really much improvement, then you're going to see a very, very, very sharp loss in confidence and another big fall in the in various industries, the stock market as well as so on. There'll be another big fall in the first half of 2009.
Well, there's another person who I've found to be in the last 7 or 8 years to be very prescient in their predictions, very true, very accurate. And they're foreseeing 2009 as a year where you're going to have, for example, several major newspapers fail, several, maybe hundreds of second and third tier banks fail. You does see a Chapter 11 reorganization for General Motors, and of course, if they go through reorganization bankruptcy, Ford will have to follow in order to be competitive. So he sees more economic pain.
Yeah, well, see, these Christmas sales were terrible. That's what I've heard. And so many companies simply postponed their bankruptcies until the end of Christmas. So I think that more bankruptcies are coming up, especially in retailing, because of that failure, and that means more layoffs. And everything is on hold until Obama takes over, but people will realize that the magic bullet isn't there.
You're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU with guest host today, Paul Gandy. And our writer guest today is Dr. Ravi Batra, author of Greenspan's Fraud, How Two Decades of His Policies Have Undermined the Global Economy. Dr. Batra, let's talk. We only have about 10 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about yourself as a writer. Now, do you have... Did you always want to be a writer, or is this something that just sort of happened?
Well, actually, my dad wanted me to go into a different field. And, well, actually, I wanted to go into engineering when I started out, when I graduated from my high school. And my dad put me into economics. He said, no, he wanted me to be an executive in the government of India, And for that, he said, you would need economics. So anyway, he forced me into economics, and I'm very happy now that he did, because I realize now that even the best of the economists are confused. They're either confused or they have their self-interests to follow. So economics is a very difficult, it's not a difficult subject if you want to follow the truth. But there's a lot of politics in it, and therefore there can be a lot of misleading statements. So my career path would have been very different if my father had not intervened and put me into economics.
Now, is it common for economics professors to write for the mainstream press as you do?
No, not at all. Most economists, as I told you a little earlier, when in the seminar, I made a statement that the real wages have been falling in the United States. My colleagues were baffled. They said, well, it doesn't fit with our theory. Our mathematical models don't accept that. I said, well, this is a reality. And so most economists want to write for their own specialized journals. But there are some economists who are called upon to offer policy ideas. Then they hide the truth if it is not pleasing to the person who feeds them.
Now, how does writing for the mainstream press affect your career? I know that in academia there's the publish or perish thing, so that writing and getting published is a good thing, but is it as good or better to be published, you know, as widely as you have?
Well, if you become famous, then you are in trouble. For the mainstream and nobody pays attention, then it's okay.
Ah, okay. So which do you want? Do you want to become famous or have no one pay attention?
I want either famous or I just want that we should, our people should not suffer. The poverty is rising, unemployment is rising. I mean, there is so much pain in the world. And to avoid all this pain, I put my career on the line, but unfortunately, I could not avoid, this thing could not be avoided. But so I wrote these things to warn the public what was coming and to prepare for it just in case the government didn't pay attention, and the government has not. So that was my motive for writing this, and I chose very provocative titles to get attention of the public to the truth. And unfortunately, it is too late now. Now they're opening, waking up to the truth, but it's too late now.
It's too late now to avoid this crisis. We're in it. What happens on the? But you're optimistic as to when we'll get to the other side and begin the golden age you speak of in your book.
That's right. I'm very optimistic because I look at the cycles of history. The cycles are part of nature, and good times are always followed by better times. I mean, bad times are always followed by better times. So, looking at those patterns of nature, I think people will eventually throw out those who caused this crisis. Then the new ideas will take over, and then since every new system is better than the one that was replaced, the new system will also be a very good system, and that's why we will have a golden age.
Do you have a prediction as to time? I think you're talking about the first half of 2009, as after the president-elect takes office, it's going to be a realization his policies are not that different. But then what happens and when?
Well, I think in 2010, they will become serious about new ideas because they will be facing another election that time. And then there will be urgency for trying something new. So I think it's not until 2010 that we try these new ideas. Until then, we're going to try what the people of experience tell us, and we will find out that there's nothing new that they're going to do or going to tell us.
Will our country be radically different? I have to quote or paraphrase in a conversation with a friend yesterday. They noted apparently that Osama bin Laden some years ago had said that Afghanistan and the USSR's war in Afghanistan would bankrupt communism or bankrupt Russian communism. He said then that it would also bankrupt American capitalism. Now, I know the president-elect has indicated he's going to increase U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Do you think there's that risk?
I think there is a very big risk. The U.S. government may have to print a lot of money to to finance its spending, and that will be highly inflationary. So I don't think we have any really any good choice right now.
Now, it's interesting that that you say that things are better, the good times follow the bad times, but sometimes it requires a complete collapse of an economic system or a nation or an empire before the good times follow.
Because otherwise people won't change. They won't change. Why bother?
Yeah. That's right. That's right. So
do you think there's a way of avoiding such a, you know, so much turmoil that it essentially amounts to a collapse of our current system? Can we make the transition a little more gracefully?
Or are we too far down the road?
Well, most likely not. Unfortunately, most likely not.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Paul, do you have any final questions for our guest, Dr. Batra, today?
I want to quote Dr. Batra from his book, Greenspan's Fraud. The very last paragraph of the very last chapter. In fact, I think you put in a little verse. You wrote, "The goal of economic democracy is to raise the living standard of all, to erase poverty and unemployment for people big and small." I'm glad you're an optimist, Dr. Batra.
No, economic democracy is coming. There will be a total collapse of the system. But then the golden age will follow. And by the way, I don't know if I'm allowed to give my website.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah, we'd love to have that.
RaviBatra.com. RaviBatra.com. In fact, I've posted some new articles, two new articles I've posted in this week.
Oh, really? Because we've looked at that a couple of times since our last interview, so that's great to know. And people have asked us about that.
Dr. Batra, are you working on any new books?
Well, I think a new book, I may have to work on it soon, yeah, because there's so much happening now and so much new stuff is coming out.
These are things you've seen. You saw this. You saw this coming.
Yes, I saw this coming. It was there because if you read history, you find that wherever there is extreme wealth concentration, there is collapse of that society, collapse of that system. And I just wanted to incorporate that idea into our economic theory. And in both these books, I've been able to do that, showed how the system exploits the employees by making them work very hard, but not paying them enough. In the end, this creates too much supply and not enough demand, which means there's a lot of overproduction. Overproduction leads to huge layoffs, and that's where we are now. A lot of overproduction and mounting layoffs.
You sound like a true spiritual economist, and I don't know that I've talked to any other.
Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Batra. As once again, it's been very enlightening.
Thanks a lot.
Indeed.
And very informative. And good luck. I really hope that your ideas and suggestions get a little more positive attention.
We're all in this together.
Yeah, we're all in this together, exactly.
So you've been listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and guest host Paul Gandy. We've been talking to Dr. Ravi Batra today, the author of The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, which was recently re-released, and Greenspan's Fraud, How Two Decades of His Policies Have Undermined the Global Economy, and a number of other books, and you can find out more information on his website, ravibatra.com. And that's it for today.
Thank you again, Doctor.
Thanks a lot.
And see you next week on Writers' Voices, where we'll be joined by Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, author of Stroke of Insight. We're really looking forward to that one. And have a great weekend. If you're listening on Friday, stay tuned for Planet Earthwild with James Moore. If you're listening on Monday morning, please stay tuned for The Cult Show.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, K. Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.